Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I'm now here with Charles Robertson, who is an American YouTuber. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I discovered Charles a couple of months ago now from a video that was shared around of him giving a presentation at college. So, Charles, would you like to introduce yourself? And I guess we can get to that presentation later on in the narrative, but just briefly introduce yourself for now.
My name's Charles Robertson. I used to be an anonymous frog account, and now I'm not.
Okay, all right. And you're an American identitarian? How would you describe yourself?
I would say tribalist. I don't really care about ideologies. I care about people. Like I'm not married to any economic system or political structure. There's this like, I'm concerned with my people. I want what's best for them. And if what's best for them today is capitalism, then today I'm a capitalist. But if tomorrow it's not, then tomorrow I'm not.
Okay. Okay. I think a lot of people could sympathize with that position. Okay. So we're going to talk about the American college experience, because you are in a fairly unusual position in that you went to college in 2007 originally, and then again 10 years later in 2018. So I think this enables you to talk about both the college experience today, but also as it was in the late 2000s. So that's quite interesting. And as you said, there was a notable difference. I don't know how notable it was, but you can go into that. So ostensibly, college is about preparing a young person for the world academically or in terms of practical skills and also socially, giving them a taste of adulthood within a controlled environment so that they can learn about the birds and the bees and have some fun and maybe even meet their future spouse. But primarily, the purpose is to prepare you for the world of work. So if that's what it's supposed to do, now give me your impressions of college in 2007 in America.
Well, in 2007, I'd say that was a pretty accurate summation. Like you sign up for classes. They taught you the classes. There was structures on like, oh, if you're on this degree track, you need to take these prerequisites and then these core classes. You know, there were guidelines like that, but they didn't have these like mandatory propaganda classes like they do now. The other thing is that like, I remember the English composition class that I took in 2000, like early 2008, before the school I was going to drop the course I was taking. The composition class was almost entirely focused on like how to fill out a resume. Like how to fill out a resume, how to fill out like legal documents. They were teaching you like English composition, and they were using that as like the format for teaching you how to structure things. Whereas when I started going in 2018, I can't remember what they called it, but it's where they cross curriculums. It's like,
yeah, if you're multidisciplinary.
Yes. Thank you. It's like, you'll go to an English composition class, and they're not really, what they're doing in the composition class is they're teaching you how to structure your writing, right? And so it doesn't really matter what their example material is, so long as it's properly structured. And because of that, they'll slip in like whatever left-wing propaganda they want, and they'll present that to you to read, and they'll say, oh, this is just the format exemplar, and we'll give a brief talk about why this was so important, this piece of writing was so important for its time in 1964 or whatever. And
right, so there's slipping an ideology even in texts that should be fairly banal,
right? And another one is that like one of my fellow students who was taking a math class that I was not taking showed me some of his work and like the word problems, you know, where they'll like tell you a little story and you've got to solve the math problem within the story, are you know, rooted around things like how black people are discriminated against by police, and that's why there's disproportionate arrests, and, you know, things like that. Worked into the word problems for math homework. And the thing is that all of the students are just like, they're looking at this stuff, and we all get the vibe that they're just trying too hard with this. You know what I mean? Like, there was.
Go on.
I didn't see any students who were just like, you know, it's good that they're like shoehorning this into math for no reason. Like, nobody was saying that. It was just like, could they be more obvious? And like, the another thing is that, like, and maybe this is just because they were different schools. Like, I'm not 100% sure as to why this is. It's just anecdotal. But in 2007 and 2008, it felt like the students in the classroom were there because they wanted to be. Whereas in 2018 and 2019, it felt like they were there because they thought they had to be.
I suppose we should say, what were the subjects? I mean, what were you at college for in 2007?
In 2007, 2018. Yeah, in 2007, I was on track to be, I was in going for a nursing degree. I wanted to be a surgical technician because, like, I ditched high school. Like, I was kicked out for never showing up to class and being a general prankster and miscreant. And I was kind of a scumbag when I was a teenager, not going to lie. Got my GED, got enrolled, started going, like, immediately. The school that I was going to dropped their surgical tech course, like, from the school altogether, because it was only me and like six other people signed up for it. And so from there, I transferred to a different school, Savannah Technical College. And Savannah Technical College, through a bureaucratic process that to this day I don't even fully understand, found a way in which they got to keep my financial aid money, but I didn't get to go to class. And they did this to me two semesters in a row. And I was just like, okay, this is a scam. I'm not messing with you guys. And I just joined the workforce and worked for years until eventually, like, I found myself working for a construction company, and some political things happened involving hired labor, and I was like, you know what, I'm going back to school, because I had been watching all of this stuff unfold, and I had seen all of these right-wing commentators saying, like, college is just a cesspit of liberal, like, blah blah blah, and communism.
I think that really took hold. I mean, it was always there from the 70s, 80s, 90s, and in the 2000s, and I was at art college in the 2000s. And it was subtle, but it was definitely there. I mean, you would never say there was a right-wing bias. That would be, you'd have to be insane to say that. It was obviously a left-wing bias, but it was, even at art college in the first half of the 2000s, it was fairly subtle. It wasn't overbearing. Whereas I think from the, like, 2010 onwards, it must have just transformed very rapidly. Yeah, people were saying that in 2018. Absolutely, people were saying college today is an indoctrination center. It's nothing but a process of indoctrination. So, yeah, take it away.
Oh, well, yeah, like, that's the general vibe that everybody had. But I've always had, like, I recognize that, and that's not wrong. Like, one of my professors had autographed communist propaganda flyers from Asia on the wall of his classroom. All right, like, so they're not wrong when they say that. But I am the kind, I don't really listen to a whole lot of right-wing content. I mostly listen to left-wing content because I want to hear what they're saying. I like the argument, right? So yeah. I went into university like, all right, shields up. Let's see what kind of a fight these guys are putting forward. You know, because there's always the possibility that I'm just wrong and they are, in fact, the smart boys. And they know something I don't. So I'm going to walk into their house and see what they have to say. And they've got nothing to say. Like, they're entirely unprepared for us. Like, you guys have no idea. If it wasn't for COVID happening right now, I would still be in college right now. I don't want to spend $14,000 to get kicked out for not being vaccinated. But the professors, they think they're not in an echo chamber, dude. They are in an echo chamber at the top of an ivory tower at the top of the mountains of delusion. All right. They have no connection to reality at all. They think that our straw men, they think their straw men of our arguments are our legitimate arguments. And they're sitting around straw manning those straw men. So when you sit in their classroom and they make some ludicrous claim, like there's no biological basis for the distinction between human races, and you just throw up your hand and go, I just emailed you a list of 5 different sources showing why that's not true. And I can go through them right now if you'd like.
Yeah.
When you do, they don't know how to respond to stuff like that.
Not prepared at all. This is an interesting, there's an interesting parallel here with COVID. I don't want to get onto the COVID thing now, but we'll get onto that later. But I'll just mention a parallel here where people used to think that their doctor, their local doctor, their GP, knew about basically everything, like all of medicine. And because medicine, even 50 years ago, wasn't nearly as vast as it is today, the body of medical knowledge and the knowledge of medicines and so on, and you know, common conditions, was fairly limited compared to today. And so your average GP could know a great percentage of what there was to know. And so, and I think people still have that conception in their heads that the GP knows what he's talking about and he knows everything. But actually, with COVID, what we find out is that they're really just the GP is just repeating what he's been told from on high. And I think in the same way, we used to have, well, a lot of people still do have this conception of the college lecturer or the university lecturer as a highly learned man, a very educated man. And in fact, in this age, the truth is that they are just repeating stuff that they have been told, and they really don't understand it in fully at all. Oh. Even their own side of it, let alone our side of things. They understand, their understanding is extremely limited. Then not only do they not understand the concepts, they don't even know the concepts. And you know, something like that there's no biological basis for distinguishing between different races. Well, first of all, obvious answer to that is, well, then what is white privilege? What is white supremacy? What is racism? How can you be racist if there are no races? You know, that kind of stuff. But then also biologically, okay, so it's there's more diversity within races than between them, but that doesn't matter because it's inconsequential genes where the variance is within a race, whereas the genes which vary between races are much more consequential. And this kind of stuff is, they don't know that. All they know is they've heard some clever guy saying there's no biological basis for different races. So, and then they think that's it. That, they think that's all there is to it. Mm-hmm. So they just need to repeat that, and it works. When they come up against someone who actually knows about the topic, it's very easy for them to be completely at sea.
Oh, I have a great story to perfectly exemplify what you're talking about, right? When I was in my Composition 2 class, which is the class that I made the presentation for, the assignment was we had to make an argumentative presentation and essay on any existing policy or law. And I asked my professor, can I do a United States policy? And she said, yes. And I asked my professor, can I record it and post it to the internet? And she said, yes, but as long as you don't record any of your fellow students without their permission. I said, great. But while I was doing research for my essay, I went to my anthropology professor because I wanted to get her take on replacement migration. And I scheduled time to meet with her in her office, and I emailed her a link to the UN's website about replacement migration because she had never heard of it. And
Can you just describe what you're talking about so that people know? Is this the UN's definition or policy?
No. Like the UN, if you go to un.org and just search replacement migration, it's a policy proposal. It doesn't have any kind of enforcement arm, but I don't know of any UN policies that do. It's something that member states are just kind of politely expected to participate in, like most other UN policies. And it's right there, clearly stated on the UN's own website. And I sent her the link to it. And I met with her in her office, and she, like, I sat down at the desk, and it was great because she gave me this look right here. And she said, "So I looked up, like I Googled your replacement migration thing, and every article that I found was saying that this was a racist, neo-Nazi, white supremacist conspiracy theory. And then I followed the link in your email to the UN's own website where they outline this plan. And this seems like it was deliberately designed to cause as many cultural problems as conceivably possible." It was this goal. I was shocked. I thought that I was walking in there expecting some kind of like really elaborate mental gymnastics routine as to why this was good. And she's just like, "No, this is obviously stupid." I was floored. But she had just no familiarity. She had never heard of this. She hadn't even heard about the conspiracy theory. Like, she hadn't even caught the false framing of it. It was totally off of her radar. And when I presented to her, she started drawing parallels to all of the conflicts that cropped up in Africa when white people just kind of started drawing arbitrary lines on a map and kind of shoehorning tribes into, like, warring factions of tribes into the same jurisdictions. She started drawing parallels to that. And I was just like, "I'd never thought about it that way, but yeah, that's a good example as to why this is awful." It was really interesting, especially considering I had been butting heads with her like all semester about the race issue.
Did she become a sort of ally at that point?
Kind of.
I don't want to endanger her career. So
I'm not going to like dox her or anything. Like, fortunately for her, I'm terrible with names and I can't remember her name. I would have to look it up, and so I couldn't dox her if I wanted to. That was an interesting one. I had so much fun in college. I strongly encourage, if you're like a hardcore right winger who knows the sources, you've got source material, you know the facts, you know the arguments, you've got the stuff to back it up, go there, go to college. Major in the humanities. Walk right into their classroom, sit there, and just go, "That's wrong. I just posted sources to how it's wrong in the group chat for the class that every class sets up to help each other with homework and stuff." Like, and just, you just shatter it.
Obviously, people will hear that and they'll think, but there must be dangers. So, I mean, what's the worst that could happen? Could you get expelled? Could you be
at a private university? Absolutely. If you go to a private university, you can totally get expelled. Go to state schools. Just go to state schools. They're like held in the United States anyway. They're like held under the auspices of the First Amendment. They can't expel you for your political beliefs and stuff like that. Like, actually, I didn't even know that this had happened. But after my presentation went viral, the Hispanic Students Union held a walkout protest demanding that I be kicked out of school. I had no idea that this even happened until like 2 weeks later.
So that is something that could happen, but presumably it didn't work because
it had no effect on school. The following semester, every semester they would host these talks called Courageous Conversations, where the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion would bring students and faculty together to have courageous conversations about the contentious issues of our day, right? So obviously I went to this, okay? And I'm sitting there and they give this brief presentation about equity. And one of the diversity, equity, and inclusion ladies takes the microphone and says, "Okay, last time we held this talk, a lot of students complained that we did too much of the talking and they didn't get to talk enough. So this time, we're just going to pass the microphone around the room. And then some dude takes the microphone and he talks about, like, I don't know, something or other. It could have been anything. I have no memory, because the person who took the phone after him was this young Hispanic woman. She was really nice. And she got up and she explained that last semester, a student gave a presentation about a white replacement conspiracy theory. And I just shot up my hand and said, yeah, that was me.
And was she expecting that you would be nervous and scared?
I don't think she was expecting me to be there at all. She shot me a look, like the look she gave me could have killed. Like it was amazing. I will remember that look for the rest of my life.
What, I mean, did you get a chance to defend your name
yeah.
there? Right. Okay.
Yeah, because like after she got done talking, all of the diversity, equity, and inclusion officers, quite to my surprise, looked dead at the microphone guy and pointed at me like I was on fire. All right, there's like, and he ran the microphone over to me, and I was just like, hi, I'm Charles. I did the PowerPoint presentation. I didn't think it was going to be a big deal. Like, obviously, you know, I posted, it was the very first video I had ever posted to the internet. It was the very first thing I had ever posted to the internet under my name. All right. And when I posted it, I thought to myself, wouldn't it be cool if this like went viral and everybody saw this and it caused a huge stink? That would be pretty neat. Definitely not going to happen, but that would be pretty neat. And then it did. I didn't think it was going to be that big a deal.
it is cool. Do you want to talk about that presentation now? Because we've introduced it. So do you want to talk about the content of it? And I'll link to it in the comments.
So basically, like I said, the assignment was to create a presentation and an essay on any existing policy or law. I chose replacement migration. Some of my fellow students also had some based presentations as well. Like one guy did a presentation on how we need to end birthright citizenship. Somebody else gave a presentation about gun rights. It was college, so like I think half the class gave a presentation on how marijuana should be legal. And it's just like, okay. Well, no, it was like half. It was either marijuana should be legal or college student athletes should be paid. It was one of those two things. And then other people had like actual things to say. There was one young lady gave a presentation on like nuclear power and the policies centered around how like political policies are really impeding that. And that actually persuaded me. I became like a supporter of nuclear power because of her. But anyway, so the general argument of my presentation is that just like the UN says, the population of these countries is decreasing and needs to be, that can cause economic problems for the future of the country. So we just need to move these booming populations into the shrinking populations. Now, in the United Nations policy, it doesn't just single out white countries. It actually includes in the list Korea and Japan. Like South Korea and Japan are included on the list because they're also experiencing population decline. And because the UN cites them in addition to all of the white countries, like all of them, that gave me an in where I knew that if I talked about, if I just went straight into white people, the audience would just shut down because they're programmed to shut down when you start talking about white people being people. So I just kind of defaulted over to talking about Japan. And then I used Japan to segue into Britain. And then I used Britain to segue into America. And because like you get your foot in the door by talking about the Japanese, because nobody in the class has anything against Japanese. At least a third of the class is anime nerds. They're going to sympathize with this position. All right. And then you just segue over because like we're all equal, right? So like the rules that apply to Japanese people, those rules apply to British people too. And then you get to segue that over to America. And now you've gotten them into having a you know, politely listening about something that they otherwise, if you just dove straight into white people in America, they would have shut down immediately.
It's amazing that we're at this position where to talk about protecting your own population will get your own population to rebel and they'll be repulsed by the idea. So you've got to actually trick them into caring about their own existence.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Amazing.
It really is a testament to how clever the programming has been to get us to that point. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, when the average person considers like the idea that we should preserve our own existence to be a radical position, like that's it's so bizarre. And like when you point out the absurdity of that to them, it's like something amazing happens because I was the last presenter, right? Dude, I wish the last minute had recorded. If the last minute of my presentation had recorded, it would have got 1 million views, not 100,000. Because
what happened in that last minute?
I told the class, like, you know, I at the end of the presentation on the video, I give the list of like what we can do as a society to help offset this demographic decline that we're in. But then I end it with like what you can do personally. And I told them, study immigration policies, not just of the United States, but also other countries. So because like you don't want to think that the immigration policy of the United States is the norm. You need something to compare and contrast it to. So like study immigration policies broadly and come to your own conclusions. And I told them, I don't expect you to believe anything that I've told you. All right. I do my best to make it interesting so that you'll look it up because I'm just some guy. And I'm confident that if you actually like do the homework, you'll come to similar conclusions as me.
I mean, I thought it was a very well done presentation. I thought it was cleverly structured and, you know, fluid delivery and all this. It was very good. One of the things that impressed me was, as we've just said, how you made things palatable that should be palatable. And it's perfectly reasonable stuff to talk about. But you made stuff palatable that would otherwise be very controversial. One mm-hmm. of them was at one point you actually alluded to racial IQ differences. I can't remember how you said it exactly, but you talked about populations capable.
What I did was I talked about the cultural differences and how Robert Putnam did the largest sociological study ever conducted in American history. And I actually have this quote memorized. The greater the diversity in a community, the fewer people vote and the less they volunteer, the less they give to charity and work on community projects. In the most diverse settings, neighbors trust one another about half as much as they do in the most homogenous settings. The study, the largest ever on civic engagement in America, found that virtually all measures of civic health are lower in more diverse settings. All right, so I like touched on the issue of how like racial diversity is like corrosive to society. But I used their words. I cited the New York Times as a source. I took all of these like protective measures and I did a kind of psychological trick on them where before I said any of that, I said, this is the part where you guys are going to hate me. All right. And so, you know, when someone is like building up a kind of like anti-position to you, when they're starting to think, oh wait, this is the bad guy and I'm the good guy, so I need to be opposed to the bad guy. When you then say to them, all right, this is where you start to hate me, they don't know what to do now. Like part, they want you to be wrong, but also like they are starting to hate you, so they have to sit there and act like they don't and listen and wait for, they're looking for that chink in your armor they can go for, but there isn't any. So You've got them. There's all kinds of, it sucks. It really sucks that you have to do this, but you have to play all of these stupid little mental chess games with these people just to get them to have the capacity to listen to you because they're programmed with so many key words where like you can literally like watch their eyes glaze over and then just stop listening to you the moment that you say things like white identity, like those two words right next to each other. It's like when women talk about shoe shopping. It's like, you're there, but you're not.
Yeah. You see, this, I think, is a major problem for people who want to push these issues. I do think that most white people just are not interested in racial issues. Their racial identity and their racial group, ethnic group. I think, and it might be that it's artificial that 100 years ago they were completely different. Or it might be that even then they were, your average white person was just more concerned with his own life. I think that this is the thing, that I think white people admire someone who makes his own way in life. And the idea of someone placing a lot of importance on his group identity therefore strikes them as a kind of cop-out, or a way of out of being a successful individual is to just identify with this group, so then you can be a loser, but at least you're a white loser, but you're still a loser to me, kind of thing. Yeah. So this is something we're going to get around. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
the whole like rugged individualism thing, and like I've made a couple YouTube. I think I've made a couple. I know I've definitely made one. YouTube videos about talking about individualism and it's like kind of just obvious failings, but when confronted with people making that argument, like I've you know, the individualist argument is like, have you ever played Monopoly?
Yeah, but a long time ago, not for ages.
Okay, I want you to imagine a scenario where you're playing Monopoly, all right, and so are eight other people. So it's a 9-person game of Monopoly. And everyone else is teaming up.
Yeah, they're colluding.
Yeah.
There was a fantastic quote from Greg Johnson about this. He gave a speech called The Refutation of Libertarianism. And he said, individualism blinds its players to the collectivist cheats. So if you're playing as an individual, you assume that everyone else is as well. And therefore they can get away with actually teaming up into cartels and so on, because you will assume that they're not doing that. So you're sort of red meat to them. And this is what we see. I mean, you see this all over Europe and America, Canada, that ethnic groups do behave ethnocentrically, and white people are just left, they're just screwed. I mean, they're just left baffled as to how they've lost that neighborhood and that company and that school and so on. So sorry, I interrupted you, but I understood where you were going with the monopoly.
You're exactly right. Another good one that I've heard, and this one's more boomer tiered, but I've heard this one a lot, is that like, well, I never thought of myself as white. I always thought of myself as an American. And I,
yeah, that would have worked in the 80s. You know, that's a nice idea.
Doesn't work now. The George Floyd riots did a masterpiece of getting rid of that, because now whenever, like, I've heard that 3 times since the George Floyd riots, and every time somebody says that to me, I respond with, I'm sure if you just politely explain that to the BLM rioters as they're ripping you, kicking and screaming out of your car, they won't stomp your head into the pavement. I'm sure that they'll be just very reasonable, and they'll understand perfectly that you're not a white person. You're just a person who happens to be white. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, there was a meme a few weeks ago, I can't remember what it was, an expression, and it was, it doesn't matter if you don't hate them, they will still hate you. And this is to do with, obviously, BLM, you know, racial activists who are absolutely motivated by anti-white hatred. I mean, there's no question of it. All this bollocks about equality and more money for them programs and all, you know, all that stuff, it really ultimately is that they are motivated by anti-white racism. There is no need for another word.
Yeah, it's unquestionable. Like, to look at the behavior of like BLM and Antifa, and to even try to make the argument that they're not motivated by at least some level of anti-white like bigotry is just ridiculous. You know, it's like staring you in the face. And it's like this recently, you know, the kind of normie tier liberals, conservatives were kind of forced to start acknowledging the racial root of the matter with all of the CRT in schools. Like that finally coming to light after we evil conspiracy theorists have been screaming about it for years. Suddenly COVID happens. All the kids have to start taking school online. Mom sees what the kid's actually learning in school and goes, wait a minute. And there's like this new stuff they're putting in schools. It's like, yo folks, this ain't new. Like this has been going on for a while. I read the Diary of Anne Frank 4 times in public school. I read it in 4th grade. I read it in 5th grade. I read it in 7th grade. And I read it in 9th grade. This has been going on for a while.
The thing about CRT that's amazing with the left is that they'll say, but it's got nothing to do. It's not education. It's not propaganda. It's not indoctrination. It's really a legal thing. But then they'll insist that they be allowed to teach it in schools. Well, then then it's obviously not still just a legal thing. It might have originated in that, but it's now because it's now obviously propaganda, indoctrination, and it's an educational thing, because otherwise you wouldn't be demanding the right to teach it in schools. I mean, the obvious lie there is amazing.
This is the kind of like sophistry of our modern discourse that drives me completely insane. It's that like people, they form these attachments to these words. And I've heard you and some of your other guests talking about like, well, what even is the left? Like, cause if you go back to its like etymological origins with the French Revolution, you get into all this like wordy word stuff about like what this means. No, words are just symbols that represent real things in the real world. Okay. A word is just a symbol that represents a real thing that actually exists out there. And so like when I say the left, you know who I'm talking about, right? And when I say like the woke mob, you know who I'm talking about. When I say right wing, you know who I'm talking about. And what the left will do is they know that like midwits like are not capable of distinguishing between the word and the concept that the word represents, because like it's just a limitation of their thinking. And so they'll just sit there and bend and twist and do whatever they have to make the word what they need it to mean right now in order to win the conversation. And it's so frustrating and like really stupid. And
it's one of those things that infuriates me when they're openly lying, and you know they're lying, they know they're lying, but they also know that it will work for them. So you have to really hold it, you know, and get it very clarified, get them to admit certain things, because otherwise they'll just twist it. Mm-hmm. And as you say, the midwit won't know the difference. That's the trouble.
Right. And it's like that video I sent you where I was talking about the debate between Destiny and Martinez, right? Where they're debating the Great Replacement. And
oh, well, Destiny is expert at pretending to misunderstand things and needing them to be defined. And it's just so incredibly tedious.
Yeah, that's the exact word I was going to use, tedious. It's just like, I'm going to sit here and pretend to not understand what you're talking about for the sake of like trying to pick apart your definition. Because you just want to say the thing and then move on to the point, right? But no, he wants to sit there and find... If I just get you to keep defining things, eventually you're going to define something in a kind of lazy way, and then I'm going to be able to play with that and twist it around and form a linguistic solution. That's something that my contemporary philosophy professor talked about a lot, was linguistic solutions to problems.
What does that mean?
It means that like if there's some kind of like cultural problem with a society or maybe like any group of people, right, has a kind of culture laden within it, from a sports team all the way up to the like the human race at large. And if you've got some kind of like cultural problem within that system, You can change the language that they use to describe their problems and their solutions so that that cultural problem just kind of falls out of existence. Maybe because you don't have a word for it anymore. Maybe because you changed the definitions of a few things so that we can discuss topics in this field without ever landing on that problem. But it's literally just verbal gymnastics to avoid reality. And I said to him, in class, I was just like, listen, there's no linguistic solution to being at the top of a tree waiting for the pack of wolves at the bottom of the tree to go away. Right? There's no linguistic solution to that because that's a real problem.
See, and exactly, and you know, with Destiny, I wish that he would be forced into a situation where he just had to be a realist, where he just had to face reality, so that he couldn't go for this endless sophistry and point missing and obfuscation, and he just had to deal with reality. I'd love to watch that because it would be satisfying to see him finally having to be honest.
I would love to debate Destiny. But I got locked out of my Twitter account for defending Kyle Rittenhouse, and now all I have is Gab, and I don't know how to get a hold of him. So if any of you know how to get a hold of him, let him know that I want to debate him on The Great Replacement. And my argument is essentially that he has already conceded and that I have won. That's my argument. At the start of the debate with Martinez, he conceded that the white population is in decline and the non-white population is at an increase, and this effectively amounts to the white population being replaced by the non-white population. All right? That's the thing. Okay. We acknowledge that the problem is there. We need to now move on to a discussion about how to solve the problem.
See, I would also go in for say, I would also say that that problem is being artificially induced. You know, by discouraging childbirth in white countries and all that, but then he would say, "But that also affects the non-whites in those countries."
Well, here's the real rub there. All right, whether or not it's being deliberately induced doesn't matter.
That's true. That's a good point.
Right? Like it is irrelevant to the conversation. See, it's like, and I mean, like I said this exact same thing in my YouTube video, but like when I'm driving my car and I discover that my brakes are not working, it does not matter if someone cut them or not. What matters is getting the car safely to a stop and not dying in a crash. Okay. Once I've gotten the car safely to a stop, then we can investigate. Now finding out why the brakes doesn't work, like it matters now. But while I'm in the car, it doesn't matter if I ran over something and the brake lines got snagged, or if one of my countless evil psychotic exes decided to cut my brake lines. Like, none of that matters. What matters is I need to get this car safely to a stop.
Yeah, exactly. The reality remains the same. The current situation remains the same, regardless of its origins.
Yeah, and then you, like, from there, like, the only thing that they can argue is they can just fall into the nonsense nihilism argument of why does it even matter? And then you just reply that back to them, like, why does anything matter? Like, why does anything matter? Why does this conversation matter? Why does this planet matter? Why does the sun matter? Like, this is nonsense. Like, existence is preferable to non-existence. This fact is self-evident. To argue that this is not self-evident is an argument from absurdity. I do not have any obligations, moral or otherwise, to justify the existence of my people to you or anyone else. I can see that my people are facing an existential threat. That is a problem. I want that problem addressed. This problem is not unique to my people. The Tibetan people are also facing an existential threat of a similar makeup. They're facing demographic replacement and extinction as a consequence of it. Theirs is obviously deliberate, and concern for that issue was considered a left-wing issue in the 1990s. But then when people started making parallels between the Tibetan issue and the California issue, which is when like whites were being demographically replaced by Hispanics, or I'm sorry, mestizos, I can't remember what the correct term for those people is, but I learned recently that Hispanic is just a word to describe Spanish speakers and is not actually applicable to the people south of the Mexican border.
I think it is mestizo.
Yeah, mestizo. You know what I'm talking about. Like, you know the real thing that I'm representing with these.
Oh, practices. Is it Mesoamericans?
Yeah,
whatever
the term is. But yeah, those guys. People started drawing parallels between the Tibetan issue and the California issue, and then the left just stopped talking about it, and no one ever brought it up again. And then the Dalai Lama had our back. Like, back in, I think it was 2017, the Dalai Lama said Europe was for Europeans, and I was just like, dude, every chance I get, I'm going to bring up the Tibet issue, because you've got my back, I've got yours.
Yeah, I think that was when he basically got deplatformed. He's no longer, you never hear about him now.
No.
He's sort of been unpersoned because clearly he hasn't been to Davos enough. So he's still got, you know, sane ideas about these things.
Did you hear about what China did in that, what was it, Doctor Strange? That Marvel movie, Doctor Strange, about the sword?
No.
Okay, so part of the backstory.
Go on.
Part of the backstory for Doctor Strange is that he goes to the Tibetan mountains and learns sorcery there from this like ancient Tibetan monk, right? Well, China doesn't like acknowledge the existence of the Tibetan people as a distinct people, so they put pressure on Marvel Studios through like their connections at Disney, and they made Marvel cast a white woman to play the ancient Tibetan monk that freaking Strange learns sorcery from.
So then Disney would have that problem to deal with, that they've cast a white actor in a...
Mm-hmm. But like dealing with whitewashing the character was less blowback than dealing with acknowledging the existence of the Tibetan people. Because if they had acknowledged the existence of the Tibetan people, they wouldn't have been able to sell the movie in China.
See, this is the first example I've heard of Hollywood actually bending the knee to China. I'm sure there are other examples. I've heard about it as a thing.
The Red Dawn remake. The Red Dawn remake. Don't watch the remake. It's terrible. China was supposed to be the villain of the Red Dawn remake, but they literally said, we will not print your DVDs if you make us the villain. So they did this last minute, like convoluted cockamamie nonsense scheme to say that North Korea basically like rose up, took over all of Asia, and then invaded the United States.
Well, that's preposterous. But is this because China is now such a massive market for films? Because I this is something I've noted recently, the last couple of years, that Hollywood just doesn't seem to be as big a thing in our culture as it used to be. I mean, 20 years ago, it was a massive part of daily life. Now it doesn't seem to be. It seems to be falling away. And
I'm sorry. First, I just remembered two things.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, I wanted to apologize to you that you are a Scottish person and the politics in my country affects your country. I think that that's kind of messed up. I'm sorry about that. Also, a very dear friend of mine insisted that I ask you this, and you're such a charismatic person that I almost forgot.
Is that about fried Mars bars?
No. I need you to say the words purple burglar alarm.
Yeah, this came up a few months ago. Yeah, okay, I'll do it. Purple burglar alarm. All right?
All right, you succeeded. You I'm sorry I just ADHD'd out there, but I had to get that out before I forgot it again.
That's fine. Where was I? Oh, I forgot what I was saying about China. What's that about?
And they're an economic powerhouse because they're such a huge market.
Oh, yeah. Whereas Hollywood cinema, it just doesn't seem to be as big a thing now as it was to like 20, 30 years ago, where it was. I think that, yeah, there are multiple reasons for this, but I think that, you know, I can understand why Hollywood would now feel an economic imperative to placate China. But I don't believe that they, you know, the Chinese own Hollywood studios or whatever. That's preposterous.
This is actually kind of a built-in shortfall of capitalism, because like the, you know, the American economy was growing, it was growing really strong, it was growing for a really long time. But now, like, it's kind of like the United States and China, it's kind of like Bitcoin and some other cryptocurrency, right? Like, everybody made a lot of money off of Bitcoin who got into it in the early days. Like, their investment grew, it climbed to the top, it's reigning supreme, it's a strong currency, right? But there are these other coins out there that have the potential to explode to just as high of a level as Bitcoin did. And so if you want a stable investment, you put your money in Bitcoin right now. But if you want to potentially like yield high rewards, yield high returns off of that investment, you've got to invest in something that hasn't exploded yet. And American, like our ruling class, not just in America, but in like the West at large, has invested a lot of money in China because they're expecting to see a lot of industrial and economic growth coming out of China. All right. That's where the numbers are small, but the numbers are going to be big later. And so like that's what it is. So when you take capitalism and apply it on a global stage, there is an obvious incentive for your aristocracy, your noble class, your ruling class, to just straight up abandon the country economically. Because if I can take my $1 million and go to some third world ditch country and invest it in some third world ditch company and buy all the stock for a penny, and then the stock goes up by 2 pennies, I just tripled my money.
Yeah, indeed. I don't know about this stuff. So I'm not qualified to comment on it. But it does seem like, you know, speculative speculators, capitalists, financiers, and all this are obviously making a killing in different ways. And I know that China is there are high hopes for it. It does seem like it's going to be the superpower in the near future. Has very interesting implications for America.
Like, if it survives, I don't know. Like, I used to be the guy who could tell you what was going to happen like 2 years out. But ever since COVID, I have no idea what's going on. They got me so bad with COVID, dude. They got me bad. When this all first came out, I literally like called my job, said I wasn't going in. I immediately switched over to online classes as soon as it was an option. I locked myself in my room, not in my house, in my room for like 2 months, because the stuff I was reading, I thought that this was like some kind of leaked bioweapon that was like going to sterilize the population or something. And I was just like, nope. I bought the mask. I bought the gloves. I think I spent like $300 on Lysol. And I was already a kind of paranoid guy, so I had like food and stuff stocked up, and I just lived off that. They got me bad, man. I bought it hook, line, and sinker. But then, like, as more and more like information started coming to light out of all these other countries, it was like, wait a minute, I was played. Like, this is a bad cough. It's a really bad cough. Like, I know a lot of people who have gotten it. Interestingly, I don't know anyone who smokes cigarettes who has caught this virus. Other people have also made this observation. I don't know if this is just a fluke of where I'm at in the world or if there's something to that, but I do not know a single person who smokes cigarettes regularly who has had any problems with the virus at all.
Well, I mean, I don't know anyone who's had serious problems with the virus, smokers or otherwise. I certainly don't know anyone who's died from it. It's clearly been massively overhyped. I mean, this is something we're going to talk about COVID. I think the American experience of COVID has been quite different from the British, the European, the Australian, and the Canadian experience. would you like to summarize what the last 2 years have been like? Because it's sort of from March 2020 in your area. I know that it'll differ by state as well. I know that.
I left one state and moved to another one during that time. So, when this all started, I was still in Georgia. I was still going to Georgia Southern University. During the lockdowns, I posted two YouTube videos. One I called Trouble Breathing, and it was basically a way too long book review about the book Breathing by Franco Berardi, which is the communist propaganda book that we were assigned for my contemporary philosophy class. It's literally like, bless. He actually explicitly says in the book he doesn't understand why procreating is considered preferable to not procreating. Like, that's a quote. God. But anyway, I also did a YouTube video about my final paper for that class, which I titled Reconstructing Whiteness, which I think that you'll love if you watch it. You definitely should. But yeah, I spent that time like locked in my house, just watching everything through Twitter and like social media feeds. And everybody just kind of went in their house and stayed there, except for the people who thought that it was all nonsense. But like all of the people that I knew who thought it was nonsense were kind of crazy. Anyway. When as I'm seeing all this happen, I'm just like, okay, so I know riots are coming. I just don't know when, and I don't know what's going to spark them. And I know that I don't want to be living in Savannah, Georgia when they start. So I ran off to the old hometown. I'm in the foothills of the Ozark Mountains, and it's like living in a snow globe here. Like, most people have like barely any internet connection because it's so rural. And they don't, this stuff just kind of didn't exist to them. Like very few people, like the people who watched CNN were taking it seriously. But everybody else was just like, meh, whatever. Because this is a part of the country where like men in their 70s will drive out into the frickin' forest to chop down trees by themselves with no cell phone reception. And like they don't even consider this a risky endeavor. So they didn't really care much here. And
right, yeah.
But by the time that it did sweep through, people were shocked. A lot of people didn't think it was real. But it swept through. Like, my grandparents got it, and they're fine. Lost sense of smell for a while, and they had, like, really bad aches. Like, it's a bad cough. Like, it's not just a cough. Like, it's a bad cough. But is it, like, shut down the world supply line bad? No, this was massively overhyped.
Like, yeah, massively. I agree.
China had dudes with stormtrooper apparel marching down the street with flamethrowers shooting Lysol. Like, they were bolting people in their apartments and stuff. So like, when I saw all that stuff, I was like, oh no, this is serious. And then this, I was kind of disappointed, actually. Like, this is the plague.
Yeah, is this going to be the apocalypse? I think there were some people who were sort of gearing up for that, almost, you know, sort of desperado fantasy that this is going to be like the video games where you've got to explore a devastated post-apocalyptic landscape and find supplies and all that. And that, actually, it really didn't turn out that way at all.
No, it's the lamest, like, authoritarian power grab, I think, in political history. It's so,
But it's been very effective, though, that's the thing.
It has! And that's the thing, I think the reason it's been so effective is because of how boring it is. Right? And it's full of, like, all of the... It gives all of the lazy people all of the cop-outs that they need. It's just like, oh, I actually don't want to go to work because I hate my job and my life, and I just kind of want to sit at the house playing video games. So I'm quarantined, guys. I'm just being responsible, like, as I boot up my freaking Xbox again. Like, Yeah, like I think that there's a lot more of that than anyone's willing to admit.
That's a part of it. I think that it does appeal to a leftist, a certain type of leftist who's just a layabout, parasite, lazy. Yeah, sure. But I think that it also appeals to the type of leftist who's much more engaged and, ideological and, wants to change the world.
It gave them a whole new set of virtue signaling tools. Because, like, all of the old virtue signals that they had in their, like, toolbox were getting kind of played out. They needed something new, and this was a great... I don't think that it was some kind of, like, elaborate plot. I think that it was really just a kind of attack of opportunity. Because, like, if you look at how, when it was first going down, the left kind of tried to pretend it wasn't happening. Like, I don't know about in your country, but in my country, like, Nancy Pelosi and some others, like, literally went to Chinatown and told you to hug Chinese people to prove that you weren't racist for believing in the Wu flu. And then, like, within a month of that, they just tried to act like that never happened, and they were taking it seriously the whole time.
There was a complete sea change over the course of March, late February, first half of March, and it's quite incredible.
Yeah, it was this like perfect 180. And I think that I this might be a little bit like tinfoil hat, but I think that what happened there was like the lobbyists or shills who are representing like the CCP in Washington DC were telling their like sympathetic Democrats and Republicans alike, like, this is the narrative. This is not a real virus. This is not, and when the CCP realized that they had absolutely no way of getting a handle on this, they said, all right, that old narrative, that's not going to work. Nobody's going to buy that. We got to flip it now. And they just did. And they flipped it. And they found a way to make it work for them because it gave them all of the power grab opportunities they were looking for. I don't think that this was some kind of like well-crafted plot. I think that it was really more of a hey, this crisis is actually an opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know what I think about that, because it could be either. I think that the national governments in Europe, Britain, were clearly not in the loop in February, but by the end of March they were all on board, and so where that narrative came from, I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah, and that's actually something that, like, I don't know if we talk about it too much or we don't talk about it enough, the fact that the politicians in Europe, the politicians in America, and the politicians in Australia are all kind of singing off the same song sheet.
Oh, this is something that we talk about on my weekly show. I've gone into this at great length.
that needs to be addressed, okay? Because, like, how can you reasonably expect people to not spread conspiracy theories when three different continents, the leaders are chanting the same slogans?
Absolutely. This is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. That's probably the most recent one. Build Back Better, absolutely. Which came from nowhere, and suddenly we've got to change all of society, and that impetus to transform society. There was no need for that. There was no. It came, and it was artificial, and then it was enforced, and everyone agrees we've got to transform society.
And that transformation of society is like all of the freaks are coming out of the woodwork for this, because like they want the transformation of society to like kind of fall in line with what they want. They're like whatever weird freak utopia they've got, like the transhumanists who want to like turn us into the Borg or upload us into the Matrix or whatever stupid thing they want to do. Like, no. Like, so where is the, like, Inquisition when you need them?
Oh, right? Tell me, like, about it. know. And it's also another group that really wants radical changes. Well, is the people who want what they call luxury space communism, which is post-scarcity, nanotechnology, that kind of stuff. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that the oligarchs seem to be, at least Klaus Schwab, seem to be up for that as well. So there are very interesting things going on here.
Post-scarcity is actually like realistically achievable if you have a population of like 5,000 people.
And if you've got the resources and they're, you know, high IQ, you know,
well, like, no, I mean, like, you can't, even if you had access to the entire, like, solar system resource-wise, if you wanted to give 7 billion people, like, access, frivolous access to that much mass and energy, for you to call it, like, Star Trek-level post-scarcity, No. Where are you, like, okay, well, we've got the, like, what's the thing in Star Trek called where they just print whatever matter they want? Like, they can just convert any mass?
Yeah, the replicator.
The replicator, right, the replicator. Do you know how much energy that thing would consume?
I don't know, but I realize what you're saying. I mean, the point that I was making was that people like Klaus Schwab and, you know, Elon Musk and all that, they're alluding to future technologies. And I'm not saying replicators, but they are alluding to a future society not very far away in which welfare, want, poverty will have been eliminated. And I really don't know what to say about it. I this is something that I want to learn more about. And there were people that I invited on to Millennial this year who I really wish had come on, but for whatever reason they didn't, who would have been able to talk about this at length.
One of the most important lessons of the 20th century is that whenever people start talking about eliminating poverty, that's usually the, like, prologue to a book about a shitload of people dying.
Yeah, absolutely. There is a utopianism about it. And I do wonder what this drive now is going to lead to in that regard. Who knows?
I have no idea. I have no idea what this is going to lead to, but I don't see it leading to anything good. I know that America is... I think America is a dead meme now. And I hate to say that, I do. But I think it's a dead meme. Because everybody that I talk to, like, in my normie-tiered everyday life, all of them either want to separate from other parts of the country, or they want to go to war with other parts of the country. Because, like, how are you supposed to find middle ground with people who think that pedophilia is a sexuality?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the difference now between the left and the right is just so profound. I do think that the only future for America is probably secession. It's really just a matter of whether that will be allowed to happen.
I was trying not to, but I only had a cigarette.
That's fine. Okay, well, we'll move on. I mean, obviously, this is a huge topic, but I don't think... either you or I are qualified to talk about it. But I do think that secession is probably going to happen at some point in this century.
The kind of polite framing of it is peaceful divorce.
Yeah. Yeah.
Peaceful divorce.
That's fine.
let's just let the states separate. Let's just not, because I don't want the people in California telling me how to live my life. The people in California certainly don't want me telling them how to live their life. I've got nothing in common with you. You've got nothing in common with me. You hate me for no reason. I can't imagine what it's like to care about you. Let's just not be the same country anymore.
Yeah. It seems to have become that. And, you know, it's become that very rapidly. I mean, even just 20 years ago, it wasn't like this.
So many Americans were just trapped on the hamster wheel of wage slavery, right? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, They all got locked in their house for like 2 weeks to 2 months, and they had nothing to do but dick around on the internet. And these people, like, do not underestimate the degree to which someone who runs a small business is shut off from the world. Their whole, like, so much of their life is consumed in keeping that business running. And then, like, what little time they do have, they try to spend that with whatever family they've got left, because they've ignored everyone else to get this business going. And so when they had no choice but to just sit there and scroll through Facebook and actually read what these people are saying, they went, wait a minute, I hate all of you. And it just burst out from there.
Yeah, I do think that the lockdown exacerbated these tensions, because, as you say, people had a lot of time to just go online and, you know, get angry about things. But I also think it predates COVID. I mean, from 2015 onwards, there was it's very clear. I mean, by 2019, you couldn't miss it, that this sense of that there's going to need to be radical change. I remember saying that in 2019, that one way or another, our societies are going to develop new subcultures. That's how I thought it was going to take shape, in order to deal with the issues of today, because our present cultures and our present politics don't address the issues today. COVID has usurped all of that.
We're debating the same things that we've been, I don't know how it is over in your country, but here in America, we're debating the same things today that we've been debating literally the entire time I've been alive, right? It's immigration, illegal immigration, abortion, you know, all these things. Like, we've been debating all this stuff the entire time that I've been alive. And the thing about, like, the left is that when they win, they don't win. They pick up the ball and they keep going. Like, they got gay marriage, they got the LGBT rights and stuff, and then they just kept going. They're just like, okay, well, now, like, gender is not even a thing anymore, and there are 72 genders and all this other stuff, and all of their, like, rhetoric behind that is just circular nonsense that defeats itself, because it's like, okay, gender is a social construct, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Which means it's just it's just arbitrary from culture, right? Yeah. Okay, so that would mean that, like, different cultures can have different interpretations of gender, and none of them are more or less right than any of the others, right? They're just like, yeah. They're like, okay, so your 72 gender spectrum is just as much of a social construct as the gender binary is, so it's not more or less correct, but, well, we already have the infrastructure for this one, so...
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This is where relativism gets you. It's just, well, then anything can be true.
Right.
It's a self-defeating thing in the end. Yeah. There have been some questions posted, so I'm going to put them to you. This refers to what we were saying earlier about people deliberately missing the point and not grasping argumentation and so on. Crime stop means the faculty of stopping short, as though by instinct, at the threshold of any dangerous thought. It includes, I think this might be a direct quote from 1984, it includes the power of not grasping analogies, of failing to perceive logical errors. Crime stop, in short, means protective stupidity. Yeah, and this is what we see now in the fashionably minded, in politicians. Someone like Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, you could name any leader, Justin Trudeau. Joe Biden is obviously an exception because of his mental state, but someone like, well, Kamala Harris. These people are almost incapable of, or seem to have been trained to become incapable of unorthodox thought. And I think that goes from the level of politicians. It's also down to the level of managers and celebrities, and increasingly even to ordinary people, which is a scary thing. It's part of how our culture has morphed from the 90s, when things were kind of a free-for-all. It's morphed to a very doctrinaire culture today. It's very interesting.
Yeah, if you had told me in 2005, if you had told me that the internet would eventually be a tool of suppression of ideas, I would have thought that was just ridiculous. Like, Do you remember the Wild West of the internet, man? Like,
yeah, I do.
You could say
I do.
Anything.
Yeah, it just didn't matter. It's unthinkable now, and it's actually very easy to forget how free it used to be, even just on YouTube. But you know, if you look at just forums, message boards, and whatever, everywhere, and homepages, people's own websites. Yeah, it used to be a completely different thing, the internet, and now it's all in. It's centralized into, you know, very, very powerful, very dense concentrations, you know, platforms, which can then be strictly controlled. Okay, another one. Linguistic Solutions is the 2020 version of Orwell's Newspeak. The limitations of Newspeak's vocabulary enabled the party to effectively control the population's minds by allowing the user only a very narrow range of spoken and written thought. Now, this did occur to me while you were talking about, I've forgotten what it was that we were talking about. This occurred to me that if you don't have the words for something, then it's difficult to conceive of the thing. At least it's difficult to grapple with it in your mind if there is no name to call it by, no way to refer to it.
And it makes it, like, as difficult as it is to, like, grapple with the idea in your mind when you don't have a word for it, it makes it almost impossible to communicate the idea.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. Okay, this is a question. Your approach to engaging with an otherwise hostile or apathetic audience reminded me of the Groypers. How did you develop your ideas of engagement to the polished performance of your famous lecture? How did you develop your ideas of engagement?
So I can't not talk to people. Like, I can't not do it. I'm that irritating guy who stands behind you in line at the bank and nudges you and shows you something on his phone and says, "Can you believe this?" I'm that dude. And I've worked a lot of different jobs in sales, in retail. I've been a waiter. And so I just experimented. And I've tried to figure out, like, all right, who can I say this to without them reacting harshly? Like, and I don't know how to explain it, like, technique wise. I just kind of have a natural ability to just talk to anybody. I work a normie retail job right now, and my coworkers have said that it's like I have a superpower because I can talk to anybody about anything, and somehow I just never get in trouble for this.
I wanted to ask you about that. Like, after you gave that lecture, did you not get into trouble? I mean, with the college hierarchy, nothing
no,
like that?
No. There were a couple of things. I told you about the student union protest, the Hispanic student union protest. A lot of professors after my presentation altered their syllabi for their classes to include the line, "You cannot share classroom presentations or classroom material online without express permission from your professor." So there was that, but nothing that affected me directly. There were some Antifa guys that, all right, so on Georgia Southern University campus, you're not allowed to smoke cigarettes. You're not allowed to imbibe tobacco products on campus. So there's this one spot that a lot of smokers hide to sneak in a smoke break. And there were a bunch of Antifa goons that hung out there. And I was just sitting amongst them, chatting them up, sharing ideas. And they never really had a problem with me until that presentation happened and they learned who I was, and they learned that Antifa had actually already doxed me at that point. And they, if they had been a good Antifa member, would have known who I was and wouldn't have been talking to me. And so, like, they didn't want to talk to me anymore after that. But other than that, like, no real consequences. It's just like how, like, dude, some of the things that I say to people, even I don't know how I get away with this stuff. I think it's just because I have this, like, boyish charm about me. And I have this, like, oh, Charles, he's just this nice, skinny little white boy. He's harmless. You know, you don't got to worry about him. I think it might be, like, some of that. But, man, I have gone on, like, full-on black-pilled rants.
And got away with it.
and gotten away with it, like in front of coworkers, in front of like customers. I've gotten customers to participate in my black-pilled rants. They'll like pick up one of my points and go further with it. I've had conversations with like upper management and corporate reps about how anti-discrimination laws are thought crimes and shouldn't be allowed. I don't know how. Like, I keep trying to find the line. Like, where's the part where I get in trouble? Like, I've talked about David Cole to people. I just skate every time. I'm wondering when my luck's gonna run out. I really am. But
you need to teach people these techniques that you're using. You need to analyze how you do it and work it out.
There are subtle things where it's like, and I made a YouTube video about this, where it's like, the first thing you have to do is learn how to size people up. You can learn a lot about things. You can learn a lot about people by what they're wearing. Right? You can also use what they're wearing as a way to get your foot in the door. Like how if someone's wearing Nike apparel, you can ask them if they heard about how Nike announced that they are a Chinese company for China by China. Or you can, something that I like to do is ask them if they know what the word Nike means. And it's Greek. It means victory. And that allows you to segue into just this random single serving friend you have. Have you ever seen or read Fight Club?
Yes. I've seen the film. I haven't read the book.
Okay. So in Fight Club, one of the things that he talks about is single serving friends. All right. How like the person sitting next to you on the airplane. Like they're your single serving friend and you know, those kinds of people. I realized that you actually have, you spend more time interacting with these single serving friends than you do with your actual friends. If you work one of these like retail or service jobs, you spend a lot more time talking to them and everybody knows something that you don't. And everybody has something that they could learn from you. And if you want to optimize the utility of that single serving friend, if you want to get the most out of this tiny little relationship that you have, you need to be willing to like push those boundaries and talk about things, because otherwise it's just a wasted 20 minutes. And if somebody's wearing a MAGA hat, then you have an obvious in with them. But there are other things too, where it's like if somebody's wearing a piece of sports ball memorabilia, you can complain about how sports today has just gotten too political. And that opens them up to complain. And then you take their complaint and you just kind of roll with it. Because everybody has complaints, but nobody wants to hear your complaints because they have their own complaints.
Yeah.
So if you can find a way to just complain with them about something, you'll quickly form a camaraderie with them and you'll be able to talk about things that you otherwise couldn't have. You just have to find that thing they want to complain about. And something that people in our spheres are really good at doing is connecting pretty much every complaint that someone has about modern society back to some small faction that has heavily influenced that thing you're complaining about.
Yeah.
And from there, you can just go wherever you want.
Yeah, absolutely. That's useful advice about engaging people. Someone's commented when you said that America is a dead meme at this point. Someone said, America is like a chicken running around with its head cut off. It's losing its mind and doesn't know it's dead yet. That's pretty disturbing and depressing.
Yeah, that's a harsh way to phrase it, bro. But I can't argue with you.
It's not just America. You know, if that's any consolation to you, you know, I think all of our countries are in a transformative period. Okay, finally, somebody asks, Charles, show your shirt, please. I want to see if it's Tales from the Thousand Lakes. Hold on a minute, I'll get rid of this overlay. There you go.
Yeah, it's Amorphous. It's a metal band. It's a very, like, kind of, I guess, hipster metal band. I actually wore this shirt as a shout out to a very old friend of mine that I haven't spoken to in a long time, who I doubt will see this, but if he does, it's kind of a nod to him. He got me into this band. This is from what's the album called? Oh no, what's the album called? Ah, it's right on the tip of my tongue. The Four Wise Ones. Apparently like this metal band, all of their lyrics are written by this like Finnish hermit who has been living in the wilderness in Norway for like 30 years and uses a bear's skull as a pillow. And he writes these epic poems, and they like translate the poems into English and then make metal songs out of them. It's super awesome. You got to check it out.
I'll bear it in mind. All right then. Well, we'll end this one there because it's been an hour and a half. It's been longer than most of them. Actually, I intended them to be like 45 to 60 minutes, but they seem to be going a bit longer this year.
Yeah. Well, you've got there's a lot of things to talk about. I've been listening all day basically, and you've got guests with a lot of interesting things to say. And yeah. Like I told you, I felt kind of underqualified compared to the credentials of some of your other guests.
Well, don't worry about that. I mean, you're the guy who gave that presentation, so you've obviously got skills and you've obviously got a perspective to convey. So I hope you've done that. All right, so we'll end it there. This has been the second night of Millennial 2021. Tomorrow I'll be back with, it's John Waters, then Faust from the Netherlands. John Waters is from Ireland, of course. Then Snorkelblog, who I think is Swedish. And then Radical Liberation, who is an American recovering libertarian. I think he wouldn't mind that. I'll put that to him tomorrow night and see how he reacts. So that'll be tomorrow night. In the meantime, Charles Robertson, thank you for appearing on Millennial.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, excellent. And I hope you've all enjoyed this second night, and I will see you again tomorrow.
Good Yule, everybody.
Good Yule.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.